Mark Twain has often been quoted on his view of adolescence. He mentioned the fact that he thought the best way to treat an adolescent was when he turned 12 or 13 to put him in a barrel, seal the barrel, and feed him through a knot hole. Until age 16, then you seal the knot hole. Last week, we talked about the fact that kids have a unique way of looking at their worlds. And they look at it in terms of certain crises because their world is changing, and they have to regain some things that were lost to them in this transition from childhood. They lost some things. And there's a real regaining of things, and that becomes the tasks or the real jobs to be completed during this period of adolescence. To regain stability in a hostile world, to regain a sense of adequacy in an adult world, a world that often throws up in the child's face that you really don't have what it takes to be a real man, to be a real woman, yet, maybe never. And also this whole job of finding somehow, how do I find the love and security I really want in relationships when everybody seems to be kind of selfish, fickle, and real easily turned off with who I am? That's a big job. And we're going to see later that one of our tasks as parents is to keep the stress during this period of time at a moderate level. You really hurt the child if you try to keep the stress down so it's not even experienced. In fact, it's impossible to do that, but you can try that, and it ends up in hurting the child. But neither can we allow adolescents at this time with this kind of important work going on to live at levels of high stress because they tend to shut down. They stop working on these. They stop looking for effective ways as an adult to accomplish these things, and they begin to live purely to protect themselves, and they begin to withdraw, and they can't accomplish these important tasks. Now, it's quite common when parents come in to talk, chat about their kids, that they often say, you know, we need some help in understanding our kids. There's some things going on in our kids' lives, and we just don't even understand where it's coming from. Now, that's a very common statement. The very, very uncommon statement that's kind of rare is for parents to come in and say, you know, we're having real trouble understanding our kids, but we're having even more trouble understanding ourselves, why we're responding the way we are, why we seem to be so impatient and uptight all the time. What's going on inside us? Because there's some things our kids are going through that's hitting a raw nerve in our hearts. There's something going on inside of us, and we're not quite sure why we're responding the way we are. I remember a couple coming in, Fred and Sue. Now, I've kind of disguised their names, but I'm using their situation by permission. And they live many states away from here. But Fred and Sue came in, and they described to me a situation with their 14-year-old son. And their son was just kicked off the school bus and put on probation from school because he was beating up kids smaller than him. And they just couldn't understand why in the world he would keep being this big bully. And he was kind of big for his age, and he also picked a lot on his little sister. And one time, just that week before they came in, their son had got just enraged at breakfast. Of course, he was kicked out of school, so he was home all day. Enraged at breakfast at his mother for not agreeing to something, allowing him to do a certain thing. And so he locked her in the closet for the day until Dad got home. Wouldn't let her out until she would agree. And, of course, she wouldn't agree, and so she couldn't get out all day. So they thought, well, we've got to put our foot down. Let's go in and see a pastor about this. Let's figure out what to do. And as they were talking, the one thing they were asking for is a plea. Please, can you help us understand what's going on in our child? Mert Stroman's written a book, The Five Cries of Parents. It's an excellent book. It would be good reading. And he has a little section here in the book called The Need for Understanding Hidden Emotional Dynamics. And let me read a couple paragraphs. He says, when the 10,000 parents in this adolescent parent study were asked to rank the importance of 16 values, two that received the top billing were these: to be a good parent and to have wisdom, maturity, understanding. The high ranking of wisdom and understanding does not seem to be an idle desire, but one that is matched by awareness of its challenge. 4 out of 5 parents agreed that to be a good parent is one of the hardest things in life to do. In other words, parents in the study do want to receive insight into the character and subtleties of their adolescent sons and daughters. They do want to grasp the meaning of their children's often cutting remarks and puzzling reactions. They do want to know when discipline is too severe or too lenient. They do want to know to be able to communicate better with their adolescent children. One might conclude, then, that the chief need for parents is to gain a better understanding of their children. This is important, but as parents, we also need to get in better touch with our own feelings and those of our mate. There is an interrelationship between such disturbing questions as, why the antagonism between my son and me? And the question, why does my mate overreact during a family crisis? Though parents may sense it, they seldom verbalize the truth that hidden dynamics inside themselves do affect their behavior. One reason is that we can never be fully in touch with our feelings, our drives, or our motivations. Even parents trained in the area of human relations are not always aware of the emotional forces that cause them to treat their own children insensitively. An emotional dynamic can subtly cloud the understanding of the most loving and insightful parent, and the result is an inability to see that certain actions are inappropriate and even hurtful at times. And the whole section, then, is addressed to parents, encouraging them to cry out for an understanding of themselves as a vital prerequisite to being an effective parent. Understanding yourself. Now let's direct our attention to James chapter 4 and see what James has to say as he approaches the subject of how does the internal dynamics of a person affect their role in the family, how they approach the family. Let me just read a few verses there in James 4, starting at verse 1, just reading 3 verses. What causes fights and quarrels among you? What causes divisions? What causes the inability to get along? Don't they come from your desires, the battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. You're disappointed. You begin with the more subtle methods that are internal. You kill and you covet. Those are things that happen inside. Not a literal killing, but the same way Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount, you kill people in your attitudes, what you're thinking about them on the inside. You covet what they could give you. But you cannot have what you want. So you go farther. Now you become outward with how you feel. You quarrel and fight. But you still don't have because you do not ask God. And when you do ask Him, you don't receive because you ask with wrong motives that you may spend them on selfish interests. That you spend them on what you want for yourself. Those are some really strong verses, but important verses to understand the whole dynamics of what might be going inside of me as a parent that causes me to respond sometimes the way I do to my kids. Now notice a few of the dynamics that James gets a hold of there in that passage. First of all, he mentions that underneath any fight or quarrel in a family are family members coming to each other with unmet personal needs. Things that they want desperately to happen. Things that they want desperately to be satisfied. Longings, yearnings for their families to respond to them in a certain way. They have certain desires that they bring to their families. And look what else he says here, is that these things that we want desperately for our families to meet, very often we don't get. They result in disappointment. They result in frustration. They result in a feeling of, well, why can't this thing work? How come we just can't have a family that loves each other and is harmonious and has those good times I always wish we could have as a family? Why not? Well, I wish she'd respond differently to me. Oh, I just wish once when I talked to her this way, she wouldn't do that. She wouldn't just look away with a blank stare. Oh, that drives me crazy. There's something more that I want from my family. And when I don't get it, I'm disappointed, I'm irritated, I'm frustrated. And look what usually happens. I begin to mishandle the disappointment by killing and coveting, by quarreling and fighting. I begin to take on destructive patterns that begin to separate me, put distance between me and my family members that I love, but also subtly move toward destroying them. Paul talks about in Galatians 5, he says, you know, you've got to be careful about the freedom you have in Christ. You've got to be careful that when you approach one another, you don't use those relationships to indulge your own sinful desires. Otherwise, what you'll do is you'll consume each other. You'll be like two ticks with no dog, kind of sucking each other. And he says, when you do that, you'll end up drying each other out, consuming each other, destroying each other. When family members come together with these gaping needs, these personal needs that aren't being met, and they expect to have them met in this family relationship, and they're not met, then all too often what happens, destructive patterns begin. Patterns of hostility, patterns of tension, patterns that create distance. And it says that the real bottom line of this is all this frustration, all this anger, all these unmet needs, and all this disappointment toward our family is a result of not having a dependent relationship with the Lord like we should. We don't ask God. We don't bring those needs first to God. We bring them first to our family. And when they don't get met by our family, we just try harder to get them met by our family. We put the pressure on. We blackmail by withholding our affection. We blackmail by pouting. We put the pressure on instead of saying, you know what? This is ridiculous. This is silly. I'm trying to get my family to come through for me and help me feel adequate as a person in a way that they're just not capable of doing. What I want, what I need, I have to ask God for. He says you don't have because you have not developed that dependent relationship with the Lord where you've taken your needs and you've gotten your fueling there. Instead, you're asking your family to fuel you, and you're angry because they're not. Finally, he says, and when you do come, finally, in desperation and throw up your hands and say, okay, God, I can't handle it anymore. I need more. I need you to help me. I need you to change my family. I need for you to do something to make this kid respond differently. He's saying, then those prayers aren't answered because they're done purely out of selfish interest. Your goal is to get your own needs met and not to move towards your family with goals of love and ministry. And those kinds of prayers just aren't effective. They result in you being emptier and your family not being moved even an inch toward Christ. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Well, it's some hidden dynamics, some things going on inside, some things that are a result of not having the dependent relationship with the Lord that parents need. You know, it takes such a high level of maturity to be an effective parent. I am convinced that you can know all the skills in the world and have read all the best books and been through all the best seminars and still not be able to be an effective parent because you don't have that personal, dependent relationship with the Lord developed where you get your fuel, where you get your fuel to do all that stuff. You know, it's going to be so easy to discourage you as we're here in this course. It's going to be so easy to make lists and give you principles and tell you this is what an effective parent ought to be doing. And you're going to go out here and you're going to be shaking your head, well, it might be possible, but where do you get the strength to do that? Where do you get the wisdom? Where do you get the fuel? And you're asking to do something that's very, very frustrating if you try to put these principles into work to be an effective parent when there isn't that fueling, there isn't that dependent relationship with the Lord that's been developed underneath. And that's something that takes some time and it takes some help. And that's really what the goal of our parenting teens ministry is. Someday, we're hoping that most of you will be in a small group somewhere in our parenting teens ministry. We hope that you'll follow this course up by getting involved in another group where you can begin to work even more on developing that dependent relationship with the Lord that is absolutely vital if you're going to be an effective parent. Now, we want to move today here in our time together in thinking in terms of these internal dynamics and why it is that parents very rarely deal with these and look at these and, as a result, end up without really ever having the energy and strength to be an effective parent. Let's look at number two now in your outline. The need for understanding the hidden dynamics that control parents. One of the women that were sent to David during that time of estrangement from his son, one of the women that was sent, asked him this question. says, why haven't you, why hasn't the king devised a way so that his banished son may not remain estranged from him? Why haven't you done that? And at that point, I think David made a fatal error. Fatal in that it resulted in the death of his son. He did not stop and reflect. He did not move toward being a reflective parent, but instead, he responded automatically and said, oh, okay, telling me he can come back to the palace and telling me it's okay for him to stay here, but telling him I don't want to see him. Why, David? Why respond that way? Why haven't you taken initiative before? Why for several months have you allowed your son to be living out here estranged from you and not making any initiative toward bringing him back and healing the relationship? And why now, when faced with that contradiction in terms of mercy, why now do you settle for such a superficial solution? David never asked those questions. He never looked at the hidden dynamics that were going on there. Now let's talk first of all here about the importance then of parental reflection. The importance of parental reflection. Parents need to be good reflectors. They need to stop and meditate. You know, we see in Nehemiah 5, and we'll look at that passage in more detail in a few weeks. But Nehemiah 5, we have, I think, is one of the best models in Scripture of a strong husband, a strong father. And when his children, the people that he was supervising as governor there in Jerusalem, when they came to him with an outcry, with a complaint, he got mad. But it says in Nehemiah 5, he stopped and he pondered what had happened before he responded. He stopped and he reflected. It's so important that parents develop that as a discipline, to be reflective type of parents and to stop and not only reflect upon, hey, why, what's going on underneath my kid's behavior here, underneath the words, but to stop and reflect, and why do I want to respond the way I do? Why do I just want to blow this kid away? Why do I just want to get all over his case? Why am I afraid to say anything to him? Why is it that I feel like I don't want to touch this one with a 10-foot pole? Why is that? To stop and ask those kind of questions, reflect. Now that's important because of three things that I mentioned there in the outline. First of all, it's important because automatic responses, and that's what I call a non-reflective response, an automatic one. When we respond without thinking, without stopping and looking at what might be under the underlying dynamics behind this quick decision. Automatic responses too often are fueled by a demand for my own desires to be fulfilled. Instead of a goal of responding in a way that's obedient to what the Lord has said I should do as a parent, but also that will meet the need of my adolescent. Too often when we respond automatically, there's a selfishness behind it that's controlling it. I don't know about you, but there's been nothing like parenting to expose to me how there still lies such selfish parts inside of me. Parenting has been a thing that has exposed to me many, many times how selfish I still am. As I'm called to give and to sacrifice for my kids, and I don't want to sometimes. Sometimes I don't want to get up out of that chair and go when my kid is yelling and saying, Daddy, come here. It's a constant exposure of how there's still such selfish parts of me that still need to be turned over to Christ. And I want to be careful before I respond that I'm not letting one of those selfish parts control me. And when I respond automatically without reflection, the greatest probability is one of those selfish parts still is controlling me. Now, second of all, reflection is important because automatic responses are too often aimed only at superficial solutions. Solutions that don't really heal. In Jeremiah 7, we read Jeremiah's indictment of the priests, the spiritual leaders of that day. And the main charge is this, is that they healed or they dressed the wounds of my people in a superficial way. They dressed the wounds of my people as if they were not serious, is what it says. And one of the worst things we can do when we respond to our kids is to dress deeper wounds, deeper things going on inside superficially. That's what David did with Absalom. Absalom came back to the palace and was allowed to live there, and they lived in sort of a superficial harmony, but we know underneath there was still hatred and anger and bitterness in Absalom's heart, and eventually erupted in a full-scale rebellion and almost the loss of David's throne, almost the loss of his household. Superficial solutions too often just let the cancer go on unchecked in our kids' lives, and automatic responses contribute to that. And the third reason why parental reflection is so important is because it too often results in an unhealthy control of our adolescent, an unhealthy control. It's interesting, the scripture doesn't say to us control our kids, but to train up our kids. And the word train means to gradually move them toward the point where they're operating pretty much on their own, independent of us, in a healthy kind of way. Train them for independence. And automatic responses have a tendency not to stop and say, now wait a minute, there's a balance here, there's a couple different tensions. On one hand, I really want this child's behavior within certain boundaries of righteousness. But on the other hand, I want to communicate to him that he still is the captain of his own ship and he's still in charge of his own volition. So I want to respond carefully here that I don't take away one in order to check the other. There's a balance here and I need to think this thing through carefully before I respond. But too often when we respond quickly, it's out of a demand saying, don't you know I'm in charge here and I'm going to control you and here's the way things are going to be and you're not going to be controlling your own behavior. And a few years later, we're wondering, why doesn't this kid know how to run his own life? How come he doesn't know how to make decisions? And the importance of parental reflection. Now, we might get very curious with ourselves and ask ourselves, what are the causes behind non-reflective parenting? Point B there on your outline. What are the causes behind non-reflective parenting? Well, let me suggest to you there's really three. First, there's an unwillingness among many parents, and I'm included in this, there's an unwillingness to experience disappointment. When Fred and Sue came in, Fred wanted to understand his son, but he wasn't too interested in looking at why he was responding the way he was. You know, there had been for several months a relationship developing between Fred and his son in which they didn't hardly even talk to each other. They were living in the same house, but they were kind of ignoring each other. And as we got to talking, I said, you know, what's it like to have a son that just doesn't respond at all to you? You go in, you say, hi, son, how you doing? And he goes, meh. What's it like to tell a son, now, go after supper, I want you to go up and clean your room, and he deliberately goes in and plays video games instead? What's it like? What's that do to you on the inside? And for the first time, I started seeing a few tears well up in Fred's eyes, and he just put his head down. He said, you know, I had an alcoholic father, and I dreamt for a long, long time, and when I was in college and first years of getting married, what it would be like to have a son, because I wanted to have a relationship with my son that my dad and I never had. He never had any time for me. I'd walk in the house and I'd say, hi, Dad, and he'd go, meh. I'd say, after supper, Dad, can we go and play ball? And he would go and do something deliberately the opposite of what he knew I wanted. And I thought, man, when I have a home and when I have a son, things are going to be different. Man, we're going to be pals. We're going to go out and we're going to do everything together. And I guess I'm just so disappointed in how it's turned out. As I responded to Fred, I said, Fred, you know what? Your 14-year-old son sounds a whole lot like your dad. Do the two remind each other to you? Do they remind you of each other? And he just put his head down and he started weeping. There was deep disappointment in there. And by being a non-reflective automatic dad, he didn't have to look at any of that pain. Didn't have to think about all the goals and dreams that have been shattered and that he's lost having this son that doesn't respond to him. It's just a whole lot easier to be non-reflective. And I believe oftentimes parents just don't want to look underneath what's behind their behavior because there's just so much pain and disappointment. Now let me suggest to you a second reason why parents tend to be non-reflective. And that's because of an unwillingness to experience the inability to control or protect what's important to them. Yesterday, I was at a wedding, and I was actually officiating the wedding, and as I came down at the end of the recessional, my wife was waiting in the foyer with me, and my daughter was having kind of an asthma allergy attack. And I grabbed her, I picked her up, and I brought her out, my 10-year-old daughter, out to the car, and I was trying to help her breathe. And I never quite seen her have this kind of severe attack. And, you know, my mind quickly went to, what can I do to relieve her of her pain? What can I do to make this condition reverse? And I thought, well, you know, maybe we could run home and get some medicine. But then Tina says, no, we already gave her medicine. Well, maybe we could go and do this. No, we can't do that. Well, maybe this would help. No, I tried that. And for a split second, I just felt absolutely helpless to control or protect that which was really, really important to me. And I don't like to feel that way. I don't like to think that that I really cannot keep certain things from coming upon my kids. I don't like to think about the fact that maybe I can't control my kids' environment and protect them and make them grow up the way I want to see them grow up. And so the easiest thing for me to do is just to kind of operate in a kind of automatic way and pretend I've got everything under control. Pretend when I come home and my wife says, well, here's what Christy did today, to say, well, here's what we need to do about this, because if we do this, then we'll get the desired effect. And pretend like I know what I'm doing. That I got this thing under control, and you just stick with me, woman, and we're going to get there. Instead of stopping and saying, wow, maybe there's nothing we can do to get this kid moving the way. Maybe there's a lot of things. Let's sit down and talk about this. Let's reflect. I don't want to reflect because it puts me in touch with how inadequate I really am as a parent and how I have so few resources to bring to bear on bringing my kids to righteousness. I got so few, and I don't want to think about that, so I'm going to pretend like, man, I've got it. I know what to do. You know, just ask me. Man, I... And it's easy to be non-reflective. The third thing is an unwillingness to experience personal failure. When I have to stop and reflect on how I handled that situation last night to decide how I'm going to handle it next time, you know what I almost always discover? In some way, I blew it. Somewhere along the line, I missed it. I don't want to think about that. Man, I don't want to think about myself as a failure. And so I'm going to stop and think very little. In fact, you know, a few weeks ago, I very harshly disciplined one of my daughters. And alone afterwards, my wife brought it up and said, you know, something bothered me about the way you handled her tonight. And you know what my first reaction was? To change the subject. I didn't want to reflect on that because I knew in my heart that I'd handled it poorly. But I don't want to think about it. I don't want to stop because there's nothing more than parenting thing make you feel absolutely like a failure. I don't want to feel that way. And so the tendency is not to reflect, but to operate on automatic and pretend that everything is going great. Boy, we got it. Our relationship, man, super home, super dad. Here's my plaque. Super dad works here. When in reality, I'm a dad that needs a lot of help. I'm a dad that knows very, very little about how to raise a kid that's righteous. And man, I'm just totally dependent. I got to cling to the Lord. I'm going to make this thing. I'm going to make it. I'm going to hang in there with God's help and do everything I can for my kid. But boy, I'm going to be doing it with a lot of trembling and a lot of prayer. Now, let's talk about what the consequences are if we don't move that direction. If we don't move toward reflection, then we stay non-reflective. And what are the consequences of that? And let me say this. The first consequence is parental immaturity. Dealing with your kids is absolutely what you needed to take the next step or several steps in maturity. My kids are instructors for a graduate course called Parent Maturity 101. They're the faculty. God put them in my house, and they're there for several years, whether I like it or not, and I'm a student in that course. And if I don't stop and reflect about my kids and what's going on inside of them and what's going on inside of me and how I respond to them, then I flunked the course, and I'm gonna. Not only is my kid going to perhaps graduate from high school very immature, but I'm going to graduate into what's probably can be the peak effectiveness of my life as an immature individual. Children are given to us at a very strategic stage in our life, a time where we need to be challenged to grow spiritually. It's a time where we can become spiritually complacent and apathetic because we're married and we're settled in and our lives seem stable and we're somehow now it's kind of making our bills. And it's so easy at that point to move away from the Lord and not deepen our relationships with Him. And then kids come along. And all of a sudden, guess what? We're not as in control of our worlds as we thought, right? Man, and if we respond correctly to the trial of raising kids, it can begin to develop a much deeper kind of maturity in our lives. You know, the parents that I meet in their 50s that have raised kids somewhat effectively, there's a maturity about them. And one of the parts of maturity is that they're reflective. And when you say, hey, you've done a great job of parenting. I've watched your kids out at camp this summer, and you have some great kids. Almost always, a parent responds saying, boy, it's by the grace of God. By the grace of God. That sounds good to me, but I don't know how we did it. And as I talk to that parent, one thing I find is almost always true, he's been a reflective parent. He didn't come into this thing cocky like he had all the answers. But he came into it with, man, a prayer and hanging on the Lord and hanging on to his kids and somehow having a confidence in the Lord that he's going to bring us through this. And I'm going to just do as best as I can clinging to biblical principles. Parental immaturity is a consequence. Second one is automatic responses that are at best temporarily effective, and normally they backfire in their long-term impact on the adolescent. Automatic responses almost always accomplish the exact opposite of what we want them to accomplish in our kids' lives. I asked Fred, I said, how are you disciplining your son? Tell me how you're doing it. And you know what? What he was doing was accomplishing the exact opposite. It was moving his son even farther and farther away from him. It was isolating his son even more. And part of his son's problem was that he was totally isolated from any friends, and he felt totally inadequate. He had got cut from the football team. He had some learning disabilities and wasn't doing well in school. He lived out on a farm and just had no opportunity to interact with friends his age. All he had was kids that were younger than him. And the way Fred decided to discipline him was to ground him from church activities, which made him more isolated, made him feel even more inadequate as a young man. And the other thing he did was decided to withdraw the activities that they were doing together. Hunting. Can't hunt anymore until you stop this. Doing some work on the tractor. You can't drive the tractor now. That's grounded. And every decision all along the line seemed to categorically be the wrong one that just isolated this kid more and irritated the problem more. And it was the exact opposite response. Sometimes when I'm pressed to give a quick response, and I probably shouldn't even give one, but sometimes when parents press me to give a quick response of what they should do in a situation, I ask them, well, what do you want to do? And then go ahead and do the opposite. Because oftentimes, more times than not, our automatic responses backfire and accomplish the exact opposite of what we want them to accomplish in our kids' lives. Finally, distance in some significant form develops in the parent-child relationship. Distance. Next week's lecture is going to be on why kids and parents grow apart. Why kids and parents grow apart. And let me suggest to you that one of our presuppositions in this course is this. It's impossible to be an effective parent when you're allowing a significant distance to exist between you and your kids. You can be the best disciplinarian in the world. You can be the best provider in the world. But if you're allowing an emotional distance to exist, now, your child might be choosing to stay at one, but if you're allowing it to happen, if you're fueling the distance, let me suggest to you that the best strategies and techniques in the world will be ineffective. When you distance yourself from your kids, you put yourself outside the capacity to be an effective parent form. Distance creeps in when we're non-reflective parents. Inevitably, we move away in some subtle ways, and next week I'm going to tell you some of the subtle ways parents tend to create distance and move away from their kids. Now let's look at the third point in the outline, how hidden dynamics affect the way a parent views his adolescence. And I'm going to ask you to look at the chart in your notes, and I'm going to put the same chart up here on the overhead. And hopefully not in a way to make things complicated, but to clarify them, I want to draw a little picture here, a little illustration. and talk about the fact of how these internal dynamics can affect the way a parent looks at him. Now, think of this top part as kind of a meter. And there's an arrow going out from this meter determining what level of control you're trying to exert on your teenager. High control or low control. Now, the child perceives it as you're trying to dominate him if you fall over here at this end of the scale. He perceives it as you've abandoned him and you don't really care about him if you fall on this end of the scale. And I find as I talk to parents that they all fall somewhere on this scale. And really, there's a balanced one where there's a sense of just where they're training their child and there's some control, but it's done in a very, very careful way in order to develop independence, maturity. And the goal of parenting is to somehow to get the needle of control over here toward the center, right here. That's difficult. That takes a very, very mature parent to have the right balance when it comes to controlling his kids. How much is too much? How much is too little? What am I saying to my kid when I'm trying to dominate him? What am I saying when I say I don't really care what you do this weekend? Now, I find that the element that really determines where a parent falls on that scale is what I want to call fear. How great are that parent's fears? How much are they being controlled by fear? And to a large degree, it's fear of being exposed. Fear of being exposed. As what? As a failure. As somebody that's inadequate to really be able to raise this family. As someone that maybe doesn't have their act all together. You know, the Tough Love program that's been developed recently to help parents of teenagers, one of their main criteria that they start on, one of their main premises is this, is that parents need to be exposed right off the bat as not having it all together. So they require them to come out to a meeting where they publicly are acknowledging, I don't have my act together and I need help. And they said that turns the corner in helping parents. When parents finally admit that I've been scared to death all these years of being exposed, they say that oftentimes in troubled homes that there's a silent agreement between parents and teenagers. And the silent agreement is this: I will loosen up and let you do more of what you want if you won't embarrass me to my friends and you won't make me look bad in public. And they find that in 75% of the parents coming, that there's that silent agreement with their kids, and in coming out and admitting publicly and being exposed as maybe a failure, it breaks some of the power that kid has in controlling the home. So there's this fear in all of us. In some of us, it's in a controlled kind of way. It's small, and it doesn't really control us. In some of our fears are so huge that every time we look at our kid, it just scares us to death, and we respond out of that fear. And I find that parents who are really afraid move to one end of the scale or another. They deal with their fear by trying to dominate their kid, or they deal with their fear by abandoning him. Scared parents go to one end of the scale or the other. The greater the fears, the more they go to one end or the other. And both are devastating. Both are equally devastating on developing that child and helping him achieve the tasks of adolescence. Now, notice here that this fear grows out of the sense of adequacy that parent has about himself. To what degree does he see himself adequate as a person? Now, it's interesting that very often that these senses of adequacy are connected to our memories of our past. Memories of past relationships, memories of past events. And as we remember what it was like to grow up in our home and the way we were treated, or some painful events in the past, that tends to dictate to us how secure we feel as an individual, how adequate we feel. M. Scott Peck has written a very intriguing book called People of the Lie, which he deals with evil. Why do some people become evil? And he has an interesting paragraph here. Let me read it. He says, to children, even adolescents, their parents are like gods. The way their parents do things seem the way they should be done. Children are seldom able to objectively compare their parents to other parents. They are not able to make realistic assessments of their parents' behavior. Treated badly by its parents, a child will usually assume that it is bad. If treated as an ugly, stupid, second-class citizen, it will grow up with an image of itself as ugly, stupid, and second-class. Raised without love, children come to believe themselves unlovable. We may express this as a general law of child development. Whenever there is a major deficit in parental love, the child will in all likelihood respond to that deficit by assuming itself to be the cause of the deficit, thereby developing an unrealistic negative self-image. And you know what? To some degree, all of us have been deprived of parental love. Even the best of parents don't come through 100%. Remember, we read in Proverbs last week that many a man claims to give unfailing love, but a faithful man who can find? All of us, to some degree, have been deprived by our world, by our families, by our parents, of the love we really wanted. And it's natural to come up with an assumption then that in some way, I guess I'm unlovable and inadequate, and so I'm scared to death that that's going to be exposed in my relationship with my kids. In fact, my goal as I approach my family is to feel better about myself than I ever felt when I grew up. And so depending on how weak that sense of inadequacy is or how strong, it tends to balloon our fears and contribute to fears. The thing that can really affect this is what I call reflection. As we reflect on our memories of painful events in the past, painful relationships, as we reflect in the mirror of God's truth, we can begin to get a much more realistic picture of ourselves and see ourselves as adequate people, equipped by God. But it requires reflection. It requires taking a look at some of those painful, disappointing events from the past and realizing that despite the fact that Mom and Dad never really cared for me as deeply as I wanted to be cared for, I'm still adequate as a person because of what Christ has done and because of the relationship He provides for me. And without reflection, then we tend to approach our family believing that we're really kind of inadequate and I'm going to make something change through my family. I'm going to make myself feel better than I felt growing up. I'm going to protect that sense of inadequacy here in my family. And it means that we become fearful parents. Fearful parents hurt their own kids. Now, there's two other variables here that affect this, and that is the level of support we get from others. If we're getting very little support from others, the tendency is to be controlled by fear, sense of inadequacy, and the response we're getting from our kids. If our kids seem to be cooperative right now, then we're not too threatened. Our sense of adequacy seems to be stronger. But if our kids are responding poorly and we just got called by the police and they said, come pick your kid up, man, that's where I really better have a biblical sense of who I am and where my equipment lies with the Lord. It's too often what happens, though, is parents cut themselves off from this. They need no reflection and they just live on these two things: support from others, response from kids. And if something's going wrong in the marriage or at work and the kids aren't cooperating like they want, the fears balloon and we end up with a parent here or a parent here. And that's dangerous. Reflection on some of these past things in the past are absolutely necessary to develop the maturity that we need as parents. Now turn to the last page with me as we summarize. These are themes that we'll come back to time and time and again here in our class. Some suggestions. First one is this: commit yourself to reflect before you respond as a parent. Make that commitment. Kid comes to you and he says, I don't understand. I don't think it's fair that I can't go there Friday night. And you just want to respond like, I've told you. How many times have I told you? And sometimes you have to say, give me a few minutes to think this one through and I'll come up and see you in your room. We need to take time out to reflect. Why is it this kid is driving me up the wall? Why do I just want to grab him? And, you know, and it's got to come back to the fact of, I'm just so disappointed. Man, I want this kid to respect me. I know what it's like not to feel respected. I grew up in my home and my dad very rarely respected me, and I was hoping that my family would be different. And I guess I just want to make that happen so bad that I'm just going to run over this kid. And boy, if I do, he's going to see me the same way I saw my dad. Boy, Lord, forgive me for that. Help me. I don't understand all this thing that's going on me, Lord. But as I go up and talk to my son right now, Lord, I pray that your love might control me for him. And then later on, take a few minutes to sit down with your spouse and say, you know, I just discovered something about myself today. Maybe you can help me think this thing through. And talk with your spouse about how you felt and how you almost responded and what went on. Now, those kinds of things might sound foreign to you. And perhaps you don't have a spouse that will sit and talk to you. And that's why we're trying to develop a supportive community here, so that you'll have other parents of teens you can talk to about these kinds of things. But it's absolutely necessary. Commit yourself to reflection. Second of all, practice recognizing and acknowledging the fears that tend to control you as a parent. The fears. I decided to do that this week, just as a preview, and I identified about six fears that tend to be behind the way I respond to my kids. I'm not going to tell you what they are. You've got to come up with your own. But I am fearful. There's a lot of things I'm scared about. And I don't want to let those fears control me. They might be there, but I can respond to my kids in such a way that it's not being dictated by fear. Third suggestion is this. Allow yourself to reflect on the feelings of personal inadequacy that your kids often evoke. Admit these to the Lord while meditating and drawing on His compassion and resources. And the reflection exercise in your assignment for this week is going to move you toward doing that with Psalm 51. Reflecting on those kind of inadequacies. Fourth suggestion, purpose never to respond towards your adolescent for the purpose of boosting your own sense of inadequacy. For boosting your own sense of inadequacy. Purpose not to do that. Now, you still will, but you'll start catching yourself. You'll start catching yourself. And we'll be talking about more how you do this. We'll have a lecture on this coming up in one of our classes. Finally, purpose instead to respond as truth and love dictates, rather than as a certain behavioral response can be achieved. And those are key verses there in Ephesians 4. Speaking the truth in love, let us grow up. I just wanted to close our lecture today with a short section out of Parents in Pain, which is the book where your reading assignment is in this week. And John White here, I think, puts something in perspective for us. He says, "For many years we have paid too much attention to what works and too little to what is right. What is right may or may not work. If we were laboratory animals or computers, the right would be determined by what works, and morality would bow to its function. But we live in a moral universe, a universe made by a righteous God and inhabited by creatures who have often failed to respond to the way that He's handled them and who have instead chosen the opposite of what He wished. This God calls us to be to our children what He is to us. Therefore, we are not to base our relationship with them on any supposed results of the relationship." Not based on the results, but on what is right. "It follows that if God's greatest desire for His creatures have not always been fulfilled, then our desires for our children may not always be fulfilled either. It is better that we aim at being godly parents, even though we may fail to produce perfect children, than that we aim at being social scientists employing techniques which, were they successful, could change the parent-child relationship to a technician-object relationship. We are called to move beyond pragmatism to a walk before God. We are to choose what is right without demanding that the right shall always gratify our vanity, satisfy our carnal longings, or even the yearnings of our least selfish loves. If God has wept over rebellious humanity, then we at times may have to grieve over rebellious children. As we look then at ways to correct our parental attitudes, I shall not ask, do they work? But do they reflect God's mind as we look at our parental attitudes?" Let's close in prayer. Father, we need your help. and mostly with our own hearts, even more than with our kids. And it's that end that we labor in this course, Lord, wanting to be more mature disciples of yours and parent in a godly way, even if it doesn't get the results that we're looking for right away. We trust you, Lord, and we cling to you. We need your help. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.